Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Arvin Hickman, and welcome to the PR Weekly. In this episode, we're going to discuss the Olympics and some of the campaigns that are catching the eye, whether the PR industry should ditch the pitch, and the biggest looming challenge facing PR, COVID and the so-called pandemic. Today, I'm joined by W Communications CEO Rachel Friend, Publicis UK's CEO of Influencer Chris McCafferty, and Ready 10 Director Amy Jacobs. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thanks, Arvin.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Great. Well, to begin with, I want to discuss one of the biggest challenges facing the industry, and I guess the wider economy. In recent weeks, COVID cases have been high, rising well before and after Boris Johnson's so-called Freedom Day. And although the majority of adults are now double vax, there's no doubt that the Delta variant is running riot through the UK. Further exacerbating the problem for businesses is the NHS's test and trace system, which pings people to self-isolate if they've been in contact with known COVID cases, irrespective of whether they test positive or not. Now, you might recall this week, PR Week's editor-in-chief Danny Rogers spoke to several agency bosses and has described this as a looming crisis, while one agency leader, Ready 10 founder David Fraser, warned that his agency would ignore the government's advice on isolating staff. Amy, David is obviously your colleague and boss. Can you give us an idea of just how bad the situation has become at Ready 10 for him to make such a bold and public call?
Look, you know, everybody is struggling in different ways. You know, I would be lying if I said that we weren't amongst them. The last month has been harder for us than I think at any other point of the pandemic. We, as I speak to you, we have about a quarter of the agency off with COVID. And many of those are, if not double jabbed, definitely have had their first vaccine. And the rest are in this pingdemic problem that you talked about, where they've either got to isolate because they've been in close contact with somebody, or the app is telling them that they have to isolate.
In terms of COVID versus pingdemic, how many would you say are out due to COVID, and how many are self-isolating due to the test and trace?
I think at the moment it's probably fairly equal.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, we're definitely feeling it for sure, and it's put us in this position where, the whole time along, like a lot of other people, we our messaging to the team has always been that we are going to adhere to government advice and take the guidelines on board, do the right thing and be smart and be sensible. And then all of a sudden, Freedom Day arrives on the 19th of July, and it felt absolutely like the wrong thing to be doing. You know, it's really the first time that we as a senior team sat down and said, we've got to ignore this. Firstly, it's not the right reason because, you know, the duty of care and responsibility that we feel to keep everybody safe is definitely hitting us really hard at the moment. And we have to take that really seriously. And then, you know, you touched before on Danny's article. I mean, from a mental health point of view, as well as a physical health point of view, you know, we've really got to think about it, because for a lot of people, they are desperately trying to avoid being pinged or getting told they've got to isolate and missing out on holidays that perhaps they've got booked, even if it's just in the UK. You know, people who have been looking forward to these holidays for a long time in desperate need of them. And, you know, we want them to have them. They need them. So, you know, with all of that in mind, I think that's why David came out and said what he did, because it just felt wrong.
Okay, I'm going to come to the impacts of this in a moment, but I just wanted to ask Chris, what is the situation like at Publicis PR agencies, MSL and Taylor Herring?
Look, we are actually not seeing quite the same impact as Amy's described, if I'm honest, and that might just simply be good luck at this point of the pandemic. But like Amy, we've taken a very cautious approach to Freedom Day. I mean, Freedom Day is utter nonsense, right? And I think most businesses are taking quite a cautious approach to the return to the office. You know, I'm sat in Publicis Group HQ right now. We're still distanced at 2 meters. We're still wearing masks all around the common areas of the office, and unmasked at desk because we've got 2 meter distancing at desk. So we'll continue to take that approach probably up until September, and then we'll review it again and we'll look at what the evidence is then, and we'll keep, you know, trying to stay as much as we can one step ahead.
Okay. Rachel, what's the situation over at W like?
We've been in hybrid for a number of months now. So that's, it's been really important for our teams to be able to actually come in and see each other. So we've been having teams coming in on a sort of 3-day-a-week basis. And just like Chris and Amy, Freedom Day felt odd. I think it was something that people had really been looking forward to. And then in the sort of the closing 2 weeks before it, the situation obviously just changed. And so not only have we kept our hybrid working, but we're actually due to have our agency summer party on the Thursday,
Okay. Which
we then postponed.
Yep.
Because the situation had changed, and we'd obviously booked it quite a long way in advance, thinking actually we'd booked it before Freedom Day got pushed back, thinking that's going to be a safe time, isn't it? and it obviously wasn't. And I guess we had quite a lot of people isolating already, and then we just didn't want to put the rest of the agency at risk of being pinged and told to isolate. And just like you, Amy, we're being understanding with people. You know, people have been looking forward to holidays, they have been looking forward to weddings, and they just don't want to get pinged. So, our situation, it's not dire at all. We have had a few cases in this last, if it's called a wave, I'm not sure it is. I personally, my daughter tested positive 10 days ago, and just as we came out of isolation, my husband tested positive. So I'm in isolation too at the moment. So, crikey. So I'm feeling it probably, you know, just as much as everybody else. I think the good news is, and I hope Amy, your colleagues, and Chris, yours too, if they are being affected, it does feel like a heavy cold. So it's not as scary as it has been before. And that's for people who have been either single or double jabbed. So what we want to do is just make sure that we continue to create a safe space for people to come and work in. And just like you, Chris, you know, we're keeping the rules that we've had previously. So, you know, temperature checks as people come in, masks on until you get to your desks. And then when you get to your desks, you know, you can carry on working. Our duty of care, as you said, Amy, is to create a safe space for people to come and work in. But there's got to be a balance between everybody isolating at home and people really needing human interaction and coming into the office. And whenever we talk to our staff, it's trying to get that balance right in a safe environment. That's the key.
Yeah, I mean, we've even been impacted in our team at PR Week. Our esteemed editor, John Harrington, has very recently caught COVID, even though he's double vaxxed. Hopefully he's recovering and will be well very soon. But it's definitely something that you're hearing a lot more about, I feel, this time, people that you know, than probably in previous times. I'm just wondering, how does staff feel about this? Have you sort of done any still staff sentiment work, gauging whether they feel safe coming into work or not? Has that sort of shifted? Or what's the situation like when you speak to your employees? Chris, I'll start off with you.
So, Arvind, I mean, I'll give you two points of view on that. So we have done some surveying of our staff, and our feedback is that when people come to the office, they do feel safe. And I think that's a reflection of the work that we've done. You know, much like Rachel and Amy, we've got temperature checks, we've got checking into desks so we can do contact tracing if we need to. We've got the distancing and so on that I've already mentioned. So we're seeing confidence in the office environment when people are in. But that is, I think, slightly self-selecting, because there is a cohort of people who are happy to come in and therefore are. And there is a cohort in the agency that we haven't seen for a while because they have very natural concerns about travel or about specific, you know, isolation requirements, etc., that they might have in their family. So we have to be a little careful of that data to one point. I will give you one other data point, though, from KEX CNC's COVID tracker. So KEX is the public affairs corporate reputation agency within Publicis Group, and they've been tracking the general public's response to COVID throughout the start. And the latest data from their COVID tracker says that 2/3 of people would prefer to spend more time in the office than at home. And actually, I was quite surprised by that. But, you know, 2/3 of the general public, that's a nationally representative sample. And actually, people wanting full-time home working is genuinely quite a niche audience. So it's just quite interesting to see that national picture as well as the specifics for us here.
I mean, I think it was Rachel or you, Amy, that made an interesting point before about managing people's mental health. You know, we've been in lockdown now for such a long period of time, and there is a real balance to be struck between allowing people to come in and interact and have that social network that they previously had and yearned for, and managing people's health. Amy, do you sort of have a sense for what it's like with your employees at Ready 10? Have they sort of spoken to you? Has that shifted at all in terms of how they feel about coming in?
Yeah, I think it has, to be honest. I think, and I can talk personally, you know, April, May, June, I would say I was in the office 2 or 3 times a week. I really needed it. My own kind of mental health. I've returned to work after maternity leave, my first child during a pandemic. None of that was particularly easy. You know, as I started to go back into the office, I felt pieces of me returning, and I really massively needed it. I think we have just seen a significant drop off in recent weeks, really the last month, which I think is obviously a reaction to the fact that we've had so many staff sick and isolating. But just the bookings of desks are down. I think the office is the quietest it has been over the last fortnight than it has been in a long time. And a lot of that is people are on holiday as well. It's that time of year. But I think there is a natural drop off at the moment with people kind of not wanting to be in. Mental health wise, you know, I think we're just really aware of it. And we're trying to stay ahead of it before there are any kind of major issues. So doing things like, you know, we've doubled our mental health offering, you know, our medical plan has been kind of revamped and released to the team. You know, we're still working with head office. Our team are under working with yours, you know, in terms of putting together the charter for the industry. And just something we just take really, really seriously. And I think you have to. But I think there's definitely two strands to what's going on. And one is physical health, absolutely. You know, and the other is mental. So we're trying to stay ahead of it preemptively the best we can.
Okay. Rachel, how is W sort of managing this crisis, I guess, if you like? Maybe crisis is a bit of a strong word, but how are you sort of managing it? And what, I guess more importantly, what more would you like from the government or other authorities to help you manage this a bit better?
Good question. Is it a crisis? I worry that we are going to talk this up. Mm-hmm. We are going through a bit of the next phase of what COVID is, right? And we are learning to adapt to that and live with that, okay? And I honestly think the greatest fear that people have got is less about, am I going to get it? Because there are some cases, okay? But there aren't as many cases as there used to be, and it's certainly not as severe as it was. I actually think the fear is being pinged and having to isolate. I think it's driving everybody mad, me included, from personal experience. So I just think there's some balance in here that we need to be thinking about. What more would I like from the government? If I'm honest with you, I think I'd like less from the government. I think that this might be the start of us actually taking decisions for ourselves. And I think that's possibly a good thing. It's been unbelievably draconian in terms of the rules since January. You know, we obviously had lockdown 1 and 2, but it, you know, finally we can actually make some decisions for ourselves. And I actually think that's the right thing to do. We are smart grown up people. It's great to have some guidance. And I love guidance because that gives us some guardrails. But we are independent thinkers, and I cherish that.
Well, that will certainly be music to the ears of Health Secretary Sajid Javid, who's pretty much said that it's now time for people to take back control of their lives and make decisions for themselves. Chris, do you agree with that? Do you think it is now time for more personal responsibility, or would you still like to see more government guidance or help?
As ever, it's an element of both. So I certainly wouldn't put it under the take back control banner, given the history of that soundbite. So I'm not sure that's the right message to be going out with. But it's fascinating for us in this industry that the fundamental issue that we have at the moment is a communications issue. right? Because there are no credible spokespeople from the government who are able to talk with confidence and inspire belief in the audience that they are telling it straight and that they are accurate and that they are on top of the problem. Now, that may or may not be a correct perception from the audience, but that lack of a credible spokesperson, be it Sajid Javid, who is, of course, inherited, if you like, the shadow cast by Matt Hancock, or be it our Prime Minister himself, who clearly has certain challenges in this space, I think that is a real issue. And, you know, what public policy needs to do is provide clarity. Then what the individuals need to do is interpret that and allow us to all act as adults within that framework. But public policy doesn't do nuance very, very well. It's impossible to anticipate all of the nuance that all of us face as individuals in this pandemic. So there has to be clarity at that top level. And I'm really genuinely very worried that there is a complete vacuum of credibility from this government at the moment.
Okay. Well, let's move on to pitching, everyone's favourite topic. Should we ditch the pitch? Last week, Glimpse creative director Zach Schwartz wrote a piece in PR Week urging the industry to ditch the pitch. I'm sure he's not alone in wanting away with a selection process that many describe as clunky, time and resource intensive, and sometimes cynical. Zach argued that agencies could better spend their time thinking about big picture ideas that could be a force for good, when most agencies on a pitching shortlist essentially put in a lot of work for no gain. He reckons brands should also contribute to the cost of pitching, and agency partners could donate pitching time for better causes. Another gripe, which I know many in this industry share, is when procurement calls a pitch to essentially cut costs. Now, Mischief's Greg Jones has countered the article by saying there is value in pitching. It helps develop skills, build morale, and winning is fun. Rachel, let's talk hypothetically here. Surely Zach has some good points about whether the pitching process has become a bit unwieldy, costly, and could be better spent elsewhere. What are your thoughts?
Oh, my goodness me. A world without pitching? I don't like that world. I think you know, Arvind, I was a client for a little while, and I just think it is still possibly the best way for a client to go out into the marketplace and see what the very best of the very best agencies can come up with to help them to make a really informed choice about, you know, which agencies they want to work with. I think it puts agencies at their very best. We all know that we work really hard and really smart in a pitch. And I think it's fantastic training for our teams. It brings variety to the day job. If you're somebody who, this doesn't happen in our agents very often, but if you're somebody who's been stuck on a client for 3 years and it's quite a narrow tunnel that you're working on, working on a pitch, you know, you're thrown together with other people. It's like fast track training. It's fantastic. I would also say it is absolutely our choice to respond to a pitch. So as an agency side, you know, certainly we do this at our agency. We tend to try and only respond to those pitches that we actually truly believe we've got a chance of winning. And, you know, through the pitch process, I mean, I also find this fascinating. You know, it's really important that clients allow agencies to build a relationship with them through the process. Again, having been a client, it was those agencies that I spent time with ahead of the pitch where I was tissuing and getting to know their teams a little bit better that I was the most excited to hear from. And you've got to remember that a client at the end of the day generally has to buy one of those agencies off the shelf, right? So there's high pressure on the client side, there's high pressure on the agency side. So the more that we can do to build the relationships with people through the process, the better.
Yep, I can see Chris nodding furiously in agreement. Chris, surely though, the process itself, I mean, there are ways that it could be improved. We hear about some horror stories with pitching about in terms of how long it takes, in terms of how many agencies in the shortlist, in terms of how little time they have to prepare for it. What are some of the changes that you think could be made to the current process to improve it?
The biggest thing for me, Arvin, would be transparency. So I'm with Rachel. I'm a huge fan of pitching. I love it personally. I love the theatre and the performance of it. And I know that lots of people in the agency thrive on it. And I think it's where, you know, very briefly, the advantage of a pitch can be both the client and agency. It's when strategy and creative can be explored without limit. And that's a very useful thing. And that's a very, very useful thing for the client. And like Rachel, I've spent some time in-house as well. And that those pitch moments are real luxurious moments where you get
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
To see new thinking and new ideas. So but my biggest thing to come back to your question is transparency. So bad pitches, when there is a lack of a clear brief, there's a lack of a clear budget, there's a lack of a clear pitch list, creates desperate inefficiency. And to Rachel's point, every agency, Amy will be the same, we qualify the pitches that we do, but we can only qualify based on the information that we receive. So if we're not receiving the right information, it's much harder for us to make an informed commercial decision whether to invest that time or not. So I would love to see greater transparency and the clients be more forthcoming with that. We're going through a particular pitch process at the moment, and the client was talking about another pitch where they had, honestly, they had a favoured agency. And they told the other agencies that were on the list that we have this established relationship with this agency. Here's the opportunity. Would you like to continue? And I just thought that was really refreshing. And actually, that preferred agency did end up winning, and one of the other agencies dropped out of the pitch.
Okay, Amy, I'm taking a guess that Ready10 are also fans of pitching, but surely there must be things that you think could improve the process for both agency and clients.
Yeah, we are definitely fans of pitching. A bit like Chris, personally, it's my absolute favourite thing. I'd pitch every day of the week if I could, and I do. I lead a lot of our pitches, and similarly to the others, you know, we do have this qualifying process. I think that's the best thing that you can do to save time, is to just really kind of legitimise the lead. But actually, you know, we have seen a bit of a shift, I would say. I think, but look, both Zach and Greg make really good points. And I think there's pitching and then there's procurement pitching, which I think is a different beast, which I'll kind of touch upon in a minute. But I think in the past, one big thing is finding out how many other people are pitching. I think the pitches that are 6-8 agencies all responding is a bit ridiculous. And I think we've seen that tighten up over time. I think the last year or two, we're certainly taking part in much smaller pitch processes where there's maybe 2, 3, 4 at the most other agencies involved. I think that feels fairer and more appropriate. And I think we are also seeing an increase in people who are not bothering so much with project pitches. They're quite happy to go based on chemistry and gut feel and give you a project to try and to see how you get on. And if you blow it away, then there's kind of retainer conversations and or perhaps bigger pitch processes then taking place, which I think has been quite refreshing. And actually, we I think twice in the past 3 or 4 months, I think probably within the last three months, I've actually been paid twice to take part in pitch processes. Once it was offered, which was great. And once we actually asked, and it was kind of agreed as a development thing. And I think that's been really refreshing, and kind of having the balls to ask when it's appropriate to do so. And when you feel that you've got a leg to stand on. I think a part of Chris's transparency conversation, that all plays in. And I think it's really interesting to hear what Rachel was saying, having been on the other side of it. I've never been a client. I've always been agency side. But actually, I think that is one of our strengths as an agency, is getting to know the client well enough, understanding, building that relationship and that rapport before you walk into the room. I like to believe that we walk into the room with it ours to lose, rather than walking into the room trying to prove ourselves to win. And I think a lot of that just comes from the work that you have to put in, both on both sides, client side as well, the respect that's required for that process. I think procurement pitching, which I think Zach speaks very eloquently about, I think is a totally different beast. And I think that can feel really demoralizing when you are going into a pitch process with people in the room who have a score sheet or a checklist that they are literally looking to tick you against, both from financial, but also creativity, perhaps, where they don't really necessarily understand that realm so well. And I think that can take away learning opportunities from the team. Pitches are a huge opportunity to learn, win or lose.
Yeah, I want to get bring Rachel into this because Rachel obviously has that client perspective, and she probably has some interesting views on procurement pitches as well. What are your thoughts, Rachel?
Yeah, so Amy, I hear what you're saying. I think when procurement pitches are done well, they're done really well. And I would just like to, I think sometimes procurement come in for a little bit of a bashing. I'm going to say to you that we did a procurement-led pitch back in the last year, early this year, and it was possibly one of the best things that we've gone through because the person in procurement was totally on point. So, I mean, goodness me, it was a long process. But, you know, did we ask for tissue? Yes. Did we ask for more information? Yes. Was she constantly giving that us that information? Yes. I couldn't fault her. So it got us right the way to pitch. The client was really excited about us walking into the Zoom room. We were really excited to be there, and we felt that we knew what was to be expected. And then actually the whole negotiation process was also superb. She was so professional, really helped us so that we all felt like we'd won by the end of it. So that's what I'll say. I think, you know, the worst thing to hear is a client saying to you, oh, we've got a pitch, it's a procurement-led pitch. That sounds dreadful, and it sounds like they don't want to go through it. And to your point, Chris, they probably don't want to change agency anyway if they're saying that to you. It's the excuse of it's a procurement-led pitch, right? But if it's properly a procurement-led pitch with a brilliant procurement person at the heart of it, I think they can be absolutely brilliant.
It's not hugely my experience. We won a big procurement-led pitch just before Christmas, and it was an interesting process. But I felt very much like we were pitching to the checklist. And although we were lucky enough to win the process, which was great, there was a lot of, we can't answer that question now, sorry, because the time for questions has ended. Or actually, I can't pick up the phone and answer your call, Amy, because somebody else hasn't had that opportunity to give me a call and I haven't got time. And there was a lot of kind of computer says no. And when we won it, I must admit, and now perhaps this is my ego, but that moment of oh, we've won, didn't really feel there because you were so part of the journey in so many ways that actually that kind of big rewarding moment at the end didn't feel like it had come. But I look forward to a procurement process where I get the experience that you've described.
Chris, any final words?
Yeah, I'm more in the Rachel camp, I've got to be honest. I make it my business to be friendly with procurement, and I find procurement can be tremendously helpful in the bigger pitch processes, and the scorecards and so on are actually a really important mechanic for internal organisations that are usually pretty complex. So I do recognise some of the frustrations, and the computer says no piece is also frustrating. I will say that there's usually a way around it, right, which we all quite enjoy finding a way around those barriers. And that won't be unique to us. That will be for all of us on the chat. But yeah, I don't mind a procurement pitch. I think it provides clarity usually. And even if it provides clarity with barriers, at least those barriers are consistent across all of those agencies. So in one sense, you have the transparency that we talked about earlier.
Fantastic. Well, it sounds like we're not going to ditch the pitch anytime soon, but transparency is obviously an important part of the process. Right, let's move along. Finally, I want to talk about the Olympics. I have to confess, I absolutely love the Olympics. And if you're wondering why I sound a wee bit tired or I'm stumbling on my words every now and again, it was because I was up to ungodly hours of the morning watching the Aussie Gold Rush. And boy, wasn't it special. Rachel, I know you love the Olympics too. What has been the highlight of the games for you so far?
So as previously mentioned, my house, we're in isolation. So the Olympics are on wall to wall. It is keeping us company. So whilst I'm sitting here beavering away through the day, the rest of the family are watching it. I just think it brings joy. I think you can't ever get bored of the Olympics. I'm now an expert in Taekwondo. I didn't know I would be that. I watched the mountain biking yesterday. I thought it was amazing. I just think you get these heroes coming from nowhere. I'm sure you watched the swimming where we won gold and silver and people weren't even watching the guy who was going to come in and win the silver. Like, it's just the, you know, there are expected
heroes, but then the unexpected heroes, I think, are amazing. So I know there's been lots of talk of, you know, there's no crowds there. It must be devastating for them not to have their families there. I think it was really interesting when all the athletes were told they have to leave within 48 hours of winning their medals. I think they can't wait to come home and share that experience with their families. So maybe on the flip side, it hasn't been such a bad thing. The other thing I was going to say was the story that's broken this morning about Simone Biles. I just think, again, it's an unexpected story, isn't it, to come out of the Olympics, which, yes, you know, the world's greatest gymnast, and she's pulled out for, you know, wanting to protect her mental health. And, you know, for the US gymnastics team to say, we wholeheartedly support Simone's decision and applaud her bravery in prioritising her well-being. Her courage shows yet again why she's a role model for so many, you know. Tick, tick, tick. That's fantastic. It's amazing that she feels the freedom to be able to do that and supported to do that.
Chris, what has been your highlight so far?
Watching the dressage with my 9-year-old, which is a sentence I never thought I would say.
a bit of a curveball, that. I wasn't expecting that either.
But you know what? In a sense, it epitomises what the games are all about, right? Which is you discover these niche sports that you didn't know you could be passionate about, and it's the human stories behind that performance that engage you, and I think that's absolutely amazing. I was a bit of a skeptic, if I'm honest. I've been a huge Olympics fan in the past, and I was a bit little worried that this one didn't have the support of the local communities, and of course the lack of fans and so on is without a doubt a negative. But there is something about the Olympics that transcends sport and transcend some of the challenges that we're facing. So I have gone from a skeptic to, like all of you, I think, you know, getting up at some ungodly hour. And my daughter now has said that that's what her job is going to be, that she's going to be a professional dressage rider, which is awesome. So
start them young, Chris.
She's never actually ridden a horse, so we've got a way to go.
You got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Amy, what about you? Have you got a highlight to share?
Oh, see, I'm going to sound like the bar humbug now, because I am usually absolutely obsessed with the Olympics, and I am slowly getting sucked back in, but I have found a bit of a slow start to it this year. I've just felt myself a bit disengaged with it, and I don't know whether that's because maybe I didn't really believe it was going to happen. I think up until even the night before, I thought maybe it might not go ahead. I don't know whether it's a hangover effect of the back of the roller coaster of the Euros. I think that kind of emotional, you know, expanse means that perhaps it's the Olympics isn't such a cultural moment for me at the moment as it normally is. I don't know. I think actually the Simone Biles stuff is, I found that really incredibly touching. And I think kind of all of that, it's sort of somewhere for me, it feels a bit off this year. Having said that, the last 24 hours, I am finding myself a bit more drawn to it. Watching Tom Daley get his medal, you know, and all of that is obviously just gorgeousness, and we need more of it. But it's been a slow burn for me.
I have a feeling that the Olympic bug has bitten you with Tom Daley, and it'll just snowball from here.
You may be right.
I think you do raise an interesting point just about the burnout of huge sporting moments recently that a lot of people might be feeling. Look, I wanted to ask each of you if there was any Olympic campaigns that had stood out for you so far. To be honest with you, I haven't really noticed that much that's really stood out for me. And I don't know if that's just because I'm not looking hard enough or what the case might be, but you're the experts. Rachel, anything that stands out for you?
I'm going to say the same, actually. And I'll probably pick up on Amy's point that there has just been a deluge, like sporting event after sporting event after sporting event. So actually to try and get some cut through at the moment, I think is really difficult. So I'm actually going to put my hands up and say, you know, I think there probably have been, and maybe I haven't found them yet. I think also potentially I am so time limited that, you know, when I'm choosing to engage with stuff, I'm being really selective, and it just hasn't surfaced for me yet at all. Maybe the stuff will come through the Olympics, but not yet.
Fair enough. Chris, anything caught your eye?
I think one of the reasons that we all haven't necessarily got all the examples to our fingertips, all the restrictions that have been placed on brand, and therefore the amount of work that they can and can't do locally at the Games.
Very good point.
Because, yeah, look, Puma, our biggest client, for example, are just simply not able to send people over to Tokyo in the way that they would normally have done. So my suspicion is that that is putting a bit of a natural limit on the amount of marketing activity that can take place. I'll give you one highlight though, which I think is a real shining highlight, and it's actually more of a, it's a Paralympian example. So I think the second superhuman spot from Channel 4 is just absolutely wonderful. And the quote from Four Creatives ECD, Lindsay Atkin, an opportunity to present Paralympians in a way that they haven't been seen before, pointing a camera at their real lives, showing the sacrifices that they will have to make. It's just a wonderful, wonderful piece of film, and it works perfectly. And obviously, it's a hugely emotive subject that we've all massively engaged with over the last several Olympic cycles. So I think for me, that's a shining light creatively.
I agree with you on the human stories. I think they've been amazing. So, you know, Helen Glover or Adam Peaty and, you know, his son George. I think those stories have really been coming out. So I think possibly we've been seeing much more of the human behind the athlete this Olympics than we really ever have before.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think actually we're seeing more of the athletes being human, even at the games as well, you know, from Tom talking about LGBT stuff when he was collecting his award to Simone being really honest about her mental health to, you know, I think it was the Norwegian volleyball team who, you know, decided that they didn't want to wear the outfits that they were being told they had to wear because it didn't feel kind of like reflective of the kind of body image and equal rights that they wanted to portray. And, you know, the same with the German gymnastics teams wearing the unitards. And I think that element of the Olympics and standing for more social change this year and the athletes being really open about who they are as people and their human beliefs, I think has been really powerful. I think it has been really great. But I do think the brands have been quiet, especially outside of kind of lead sponsor roles. And I think all of that just kind of gives me this feeling that the Olympics is always the right event. It's just, is it the right time right now? I think that's where I'm at.
It's a really good point. And it's important to note as well that some of the major sponsors, I think Toyota is one of them, but a couple of others have decided to pull all their advertising in Japan out of sensitivity for the situation. So it must be an exceptionally difficult games to market against. I think some other really interesting points that you raised, you know, the Paralympics for me are always so inspirational. I always think of the Olympics as being very aspirational and the Paralympics are being very inspirational. Just seeing what those athletes can do. I've worked at both the Olympics and the Paralympics, and that's how I felt when I was watching both of them. Just one final question. I mean, I do love the human side, and some of the interviews have been very touching, and some of the interviews have been very raw and unguarded. I've been surprised actually by how human it has been. Sometimes, you know, athletes are media trained and they know what to say. It feels this is different. And I don't know if that's just, you know, COVID fatigue or just the struggles of getting here, but you really are starting to see that human side. Just before we go though, because we have to wrap up shortly, just one final question. I'm going to ask each of you this. How well do you think Team GP will go in Tokyo?
Where are we? Are we fifth in the table at the moment?
I think you're seventh, actually. I think Australia's leapfrogged you.
Seventh? I like the fact you still call us you, not us. Well done,
that's going to shape my answer, Arvind. We're going to finish above you. That's it. That's all I've got for you.
Beat the Aussies. I reckon fifth or fourth, I'm going to say.
Amy, we'll give you the final word.
Yeah, I think that's probably about right. Top five, but probably not on the podium.
Fantastic. Well, I'm sure Team GB will do very, very well. They're an exceptionally good Olympics team. And I'm sure you will all enjoy it, as will we. But that is all we have time for. Now, before I go for this episode, I just have some personal news that you might have seen in social media. This will be one of my final episodes of the PR Weekly, as I will soon move to our sister publication Campaign as its media editor. But I do hope to be with you for at least one more episode before I pack up my notepad and pen and move on. I just want to thank our guests, Rachel, Amy, and Chris, for joining our panel for this episode, and our producer, Lindsay Riley from Rethink Audio, for putting it all together. If you want to read up more about what we discussed today and the latest industry news and views, please visit our new look website, prweek.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.